Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today on WILL AM 580, this wonderful 4th of July 2010. Today we're going to have a repeat episode for you of an interview we did in 2008 with the late and great Howard Zinn. We think you're going to enjoy it, so please enjoy this holiday listening to one of the great historians of American history talk about this country's legacy. Howard Zinn, today on Media Matters, but first let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
When radio technology was first developed, the public airwaves were a free-for-all. There was no Federal Communications Commission to allocate exclusive licenses, no central management of the spectrum, and, well, a lot of interference. But when Congress realized that certain operators, such as the Navy or emergency responders, needed to be ensured uninterrupted broadcasts, things changed.
Spectrum has primarily been done on an exclusive allocation process, which means one entity gets exclusive access to a piece of spectrum. That can be a government entity, that can be your cell phone provider like AT&T or Verizon, or that can be a television station.
That's James Losey, program associate with the Open Technology Institute at the New America Foundation. Losey believes that we are long overdue for updated spectrum allocation policies.
Now, what we think needs to happen is that spectrum policies need to be updated to reflect modern-day technologies. In the 1930s, the radios they were using needed quite a bit of space in between bands in order to not have interference. But if we were to, say, equate that to cars, that means imagine if a car was unable to change lanes. That means on the freeway, taxis would need a lane, buses would need a lane, a couple lanes for commuters. But that becomes incredibly inefficient when you have lanes that are being unused or open.
This idea, called Opportunistic Spectrum Access, or OSA, would allow smart radios and other devices to operate as secondary users on unoccupied channels.
Right now what we see in spectrum is that across the board, spectrum is only used about 10% of the time if you were to measure all the frequencies in use. Now, if you had a car that can change lanes, that means if one lane is busy, go over and use another lane that might be more open. Well, there's now smart radios available, and smart radio can listen to a bit of frequency, check if it's in use. If it is, find another frequency, or go to that unused frequency and use it. This is just like a car changing lanes that's able to use greater efficiency of what is essentially a finite resource.
The push for updated policies is not unwarranted. Both the FCC in their National Broadband Plan and the Obama administration, in statements released earlier this week, have expressed the need to free up 500 megahertz of spectrum for mobile broadband use in the next 10 years. But making that much spectrum available for exclusive use might be very difficult. That, Losey says, is the beauty of OSA policies.
Opportunistic spectrum access is a secondary use, which means no one actually needs to give up their license to spectrum. Any entity that has a spectrum license will still retain primary access to the spectrum when they need it, but smart radios will be able to communicate on that when the spectrum isn't in use. So in order to implement OSA policies, the FCC doesn't actually have to change who has the primary use of that spectrum.
On July 7th, the Alliance for Community Media will meet for a three-day conference in Pittsburgh to discuss the future of community media and learn about the latest tools and techniques for creating and delivering public programming. The Alliance represents more than 3,000 public, educational, and governmental, or PEG, community television and media centers across the country. Since 1976, the Alliance has worked to advance democratic ideals by ensuring that people have access to media making as well as media consumption. The conference will address many of the practical and policy issues that community media providers face. Greg Eplerwood is the managing director of the Alliance for Community Media.
There are several things that are very, very exciting this year. We have, first of all, a pre-conference called Lessons from the Field, Best Practices in Citizen Journalism. We have Jan Schaefer, Executive Director of JLab at American University, the Institute for Interactive Journalism. Another track that is going to get a lot of attention is called Engineering Broadband, Network Management, and Related Issues.
Expanding the scope of community media is a necessary step to keep the centers relevant in today's changing media landscape. as budget cutbacks, crippling state franchising laws, and the economic downturn plague many centers, broadband has become a viable way to keep programming flowing to the public. But even media centers' use of the Internet is being challenged.
If you're getting funded to provide public educational governmental access programming on a peg channel, that doesn't necessarily mean that that funding is going to be used for programming over the Internet. The Alliance for Community Media is obviously working very hard to have legislation plus the FCC look at the communication infrastructure as not just cable TV and not just an information service broadband.
Legislation has been introduced in the House that would help PEGs better utilize funding and end discriminatory treatment of the channels by video service providers. For more information about the Alliance, go to alliancecm.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Today, July 4th, 2010. Today, we're going to have a special airing of an interview I did with the late and great Howard Zinn back in the fall of 2008. We're going to air it today. This great historian of American history, the American experience, will talk to us about American politics and culture and history. Sit back, relax, and enjoy this wonderful holiday show, and I'll be back with a live program 1 week from today. It's my great privilege to welcome to the Media Matters Airwaves, Howard Zinn, the historian, author of numerous books, most famously A People's History of the United States, and now the star of a new graphic adaptation of from that book, A People's History of American Empire, out by Metropolitan Books. Howard Zinn, welcome back to Media Matters.
Well, thank you, Bob.
It's really a pleasure to have you here. I've been reading and reading some of your writings recently, and watching some of the interviews with you that are now posted online. And I want to start, of course, we are now, 9 days out or 10 days out from the next presidential election and congressional election. Your take on the coming election, it seems to be what everyone's talking about. How do you regard it? What's your take on it?
Well, do you mean how do I view the candidates?
How you view the candidates and how you view the significance of this election?
Oh, well, I think it's a very significant election, unusually significant. Obviously, the first time we've had an African-American running for president, first time we've had a person of color, at least a person who acknowledged he was of color. Who knows about previous presidents and their ancestries and what they hid from us? But said, the first person who is acknowledged is of color running for president, that's a historic moment. And I think, I say all this, whatever misgivings I have about Mr. Obama as president, that is, whatever criticism I have of his policies, I think if he is elected, it will be a very important step forward in American history. And it will be very important for the world, because after all, the world is not white. The world is mostly colored. And to have a colored man as president in the United States, with the enormous power of the United States, I think that is bound to have a positive effect on U.S. relations with the rest of the world. So that is the positive thing about Obama running for president and hopefully winning the presidency. And as I said, I have a number of criticisms of Obama as a presidential candidate and worries about him as president, but despite all of that, I still think it will be a historic step forward for him to become president.
And in terms of the policy matters between Obama and McCain, do you see differences on key issues that are important to you?
Well, yeah, unfortunately, the differences aren't huge enough. They're differences. And anybody who claims there's absolutely no difference. I think it was just, avoiding the facts or so befogged by a dissatisfaction with Obama's positions that he or she insists there is no difference. Oh, there is a difference. There's certainly a difference in the tax policies, and McCain clearly, is in the Bush camp, or to put it another way, is in the billionaires camp, in the upper 1% camp, and he's in that camp which thinks that we are taxing those poor, super rich too much, and that if we'd only ease that tax burden, the economy would surge forward. Well, if we ease that tax burden even more, they will surge forward. Nobody else will surge forward. I think Obama has come up with a sort of different idea about taxes and has said that he will not raise taxes on, 90% of the American people. He will raise taxes on the super rich. That is, I think, a very healthy approach. I think he could go even farther than he has. That is, I think the enormous wealth accumulated by the upper 1% of the population in the last 20 years, and you notice I go beyond the Bush administration, into the Clinton administration, and even before that, as far as the Kennedy administration, that is, we for a long time now we've had a dwindling of the tax rate on the super rich, and the result has been an enormous transfer of wealth, trillions of dollars, really, to the upper 1% of the population. And it is time to take that back, to take it back not only in the form of significantly, really drastically higher tax from now on the super rich, but also something that, no candidate has proposed and hardly anybody talks about, and that is not just an income tax, but a wealth tax. After all, if your income has risen, as the super-rich income has risen over the decades, risen every year, you have accumulated an enormous amount of wealth. That wealth should be taxed. In other words, that way we would not only be rectifying the tax schedule for coming years, we would be taking back the excess profits that the super rich have been getting these past few decades. So I'm saying that Obama's tax proposal is certainly better than McCain's. It's more populist, it's more geared to the lower classes. He could go even further. And I'm plus, there are all these other issues on which they are not as far apart. I mean, they both have proposals for health care, and while Obama's proposal is somewhat better than McCain's, it still falls far short of what should be a sensible proposal for solving the problem of 40 million people, 45 million people without health care, and difficulty for the rest of the population paying insurance companies and so on. The most sensible solution for the health care problem is, what so many doctors have said is the solution, what is called a single-payer system. In other words, they'll do away with insurance companies as intermediaries, do away with the bureaucracy of all of that, which causes, administrative costs in the health care in the United States to be twice what they are in other countries, and institute a program of government-supported health care with free health care for all. Nobody has to fill out forms. Nobody has to go through insurance companies. And in other words, give the American people what older people have with Medicare. Give the American people what people in the armed services have. And it's interesting when they, what the people in Congress have. Let the government pay for it. Of course, how will they pay for it? By those increased taxes on the super rich. And I can't understand why Obama has not come out for the single payer system. I prefer to the appellation single payer, which I think very often confuses people. I would call it health security. That is to make it a parallel with Social Security and to give it the same gravitas and the same support and I think the same approbation that the phrase Social Security gets, because after all, Social Security is one of the most successful government programs we have had. Very, very few administrative costs and an enormous help to people, you know, who have reached retirement age. So, yes, health security is something that Obama, I think, has to move towards. Maybe after he gets elected president, he will be more sensitive. But I think he has, in this case, misread the American people. In fact, I think this is a general problem with Obama. I think he has underestimated the willingness of the American people to make really significant changes in our domestic policy. And by underestimating that, by misreading that, he has therefore remained cautious and, as they say, moved toward the center. And of course, the more he moves toward the center, the closer he moves to McCain. The closer he moves to McCain, the more difficult it is for voters to distinguish between him and McCain. So that even from the pragmatic, narrow political criterion of winning the election, Obama is making a mistake by moving to the center, you know, on health policy. You know, the public for years has shown in public opinion poll after public opinion poll that the public favors a system like the Canadian one or the one in or New Zealand or Italy or France or Germany, countries that have government-financed free health care for everybody.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Howard Zinn, who you've been listening to. Howard Zinn, author of numerous books on American history and politics, most famously People's History of the United States, also the star of a new graphic adaptation from his research called A People's History of American Empire, drawn by Mike Konopacki, written by Paul Buell. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Howard Zinn, the telephone number here at WILL is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. If I'm not mistaken, Howard, Obama has actually said that he is in favor. If we started from scratch and did not have an existing system, we would clearly, the wise choice would be a single-payer one, and that it's simply the power of the insurance company's lobbies that prevents him from advocating that at this point. Not that I want to belabor that point, but that he is actually on record as saying that. One thing I'd like to ask you about, Howard Zinn, is I had on the show 2 weeks ago Robert Kuttner, the editor of The American Prospect and author of a brand-new book called Obama's Challenge. And Kuttner argues that Obama is going to be in a situation not unlike that of Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 when he assumed office, in which he will be entering a major crisis. And he's not himself a radical or necessarily especially progressive any more than FDR was. But he will find that the conventional tools that are available to him are going to be inadequate to the job at hand. And so Obama's challenge, according to Kuttner, is to adopt a far more progressive and radical approach to the economic crisis and the social crisis of this country than his comfort zone would normally lead him to. What do you make of Kuttner's argument?
No, I think Bob Kuttner is right. That is, he's right that Obama is in a similar position to FDR, coming into office in a crisis, and then perhaps pushed by this crisis into espousing policies that he did not originally plan to do. In other words, the crisis may push him towards bolder economic moves, as it pushed Roosevelt toward bolder economic moves. But we should keep in mind also that in the case of Roosevelt, it was not just the economic crisis, but it was also the forces that were swirling around in the country putting pressure on Roosevelt to make change. And by that, I mean the rising trade union movement, the strikes that were taking place all over the country, the general strike in San Francisco, the general strike in Minneapolis, the strikes of hundreds of thousands of textile workers in the South, tenants' movements and unemployed councils movements, people in turmoil. And that turmoil, the threat of kind of a revolutionary upsurge in the United States was a very, very important factor in pushing the Roosevelt administration towards, you know, the best aspects of the New Deal, the help to the poor. So in the case of Obama, we need not only have an economic crisis, which may only propel his advisors, who are mostly rather conservative, propel his advisors into giving him sort of same old advice. But we need, in Obama's presidency, we need a very energetic national movement that demands that Obama do something fundamental in the economy. The potential is there. That is, we have all these people, a lot of young people. We have a lot of enthusiasm for the Obama campaign, a new constituency, a new electorate, new voters. And if all of these people can be mobilized, if the trade union movement can be re-energized, if people of color, precisely because of who Obama is, can be mobilized, if all of these people can merge into an important social movement that demands Obama change, then we may see what we saw in the Roosevelt years, and that is the president move beyond what was originally promised and do something important. In fact, he would need to move beyond what Roosevelt did. He would have to go beyond the New Deal, because after all, the New Deal had its limitations. The New Deal, sure, put half the unemployed back to work, but, you know, these unemployed were not really put back to work fully until World War II came along. The New Deal did not, while it helped a lot of people at the bottom, it did not help the poorest people, did not do a lot for black people who held the most menial jobs and therefore who did not fall under the Minimum Wage Act or, you know, or Social Security or the aid that was being given to farmers because these blacks were tenant farmers and sharecroppers. So I'm suggesting that, Kuttner was right. This could happen in an Obama presidency, and if the movement is strong enough, it could propel Obama even beyond the reforms of the New Deal into a really new era for the American people.
Howard Zinn, do you think that, you know, as you listen to the rhetoric of the McCain campaign, which you alluded to a few minutes ago, all this talk about the importance of balancing budgets and how taxation is evil, especially taxation of wealthy people, that it will kill free enterprise, and all the sort of rhetoric we've heard from politicians, especially but not exclusively Republican politicians for the past three decades or so, this sort of what's called neoliberalism, this idea that free markets are perfect and can solve all our problems as long as we get out of the way and let them do their thing. Do you think that that line of political rhetoric has lost its power in this country now?
Well, I think the current financial crisis and the sudden appearance of a government bailout of $700 billion, it should put to rest. It should really bury the idea that we can count on the free market and the free enterprise system, because that free market, those people in the free market, those people who have, the beneficiaries of the free market, they've suddenly come begging on their knees to the government and saying, well, you know, we were against government interference in the economy. We spoke about we mustn't have big government anymore. In fact, even Clinton said the era of big government is over. But now we need big government. Well, the current financial crisis has given very strong evidence for the fact that the free market does not solve our problems. And in fact, it's very important to go back into history and note that when we had a so-called free market, and by that I mean when the government did not regulate the economy, let the corporations do what they want, let, you know, whatever happens, let it happen, and don't regulate the corporations, don't regulate hours and wages, don't support trade unions, don't get in the way of what corporations do. When the government was following that policy, let's say in the 19th century, in early 20th century, what did we have? We had enormous suffering on the part of the poor. We had huge numbers of children dying in the cities because private enterprise was doing its thing. And what is its thing? The thing of private enterprise is you do whatever is profitable, and you don't do something if it's not profitable. So if it's not profitable to build housing for people who don't have money, you don't do that. No, if it's not profitable to clean up the water in the air, you don't do that. You just do what makes money for the corporation. So we need to take a look at the results of the free market. Well, 1929 and the crash and the depression, they were the results of the unregulated economy of the 1920s. Let me just make one other point about history,
okay. And
that is that this new bailout should suddenly be recognized as an old bailout, or to put it another way, that bailouts are old, that the government has always bailed out the richest part of the economy. The government, this is not something new. It started with the very first Congress. It started right after the Revolution. In fact, the Constitution was framed in 1787 specifically for the purpose of having big government, having a government that would be strong enough and financially sound enough to take care of the richest part of the population. And so one of the first acts of Congress in new government after the Revolution was the first bailout, and that was to redeem the bonds that were held by those speculators who during the Revolution had bought up these bonds. Now they were worthless. The government bailed them out. And from that point on, all through American history, the government has bailed out, has subsidized, has given its aid to the corporate rich. And they gave over 100 million acres of land to the railroads. They gave subsidies to the merchant marine. After World War II, they took the collapsed airplane industry, no longer producing warplanes, and basically they revived, with government help, the aircraft industry. So there's a long history of government bailout. And when the government gives all that aid to the corporations, well, that's considered okay. When the government, when somebody said, let the government take care of people's health care, or let the government give jobs to people like the New Deal did, they say, my God, that's socialism.
Our guest, Howard Zinn, today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The phone number here, 333-9455, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers who've been waiting patiently. I want to get to them right now. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Howard Zinn.
Thank you, Mr. Zinn, for all the work you've done, the great work you've done. How can we get President Obama to make the changes for the public good when he's received, and this information I'm getting from the Center for Responsive Politics, printed in The Nation, he received $7.2 million from the healthcare industry. He received over $250,000 from the mortgage industries. He's received nearly $1 million from telecoms, and he's received $10.3 million from Wall Street companies such as Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan. How can we get him to change when he's received this kind of money from these lobbyists to, you know, change it, as you said, from private enterprise, the government for private enterprise, you know, back to, if it ever was, for the public good? And, you know, how can that happen when lobbying continues? And I'll listen to your answer. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Howard?
Yeah, well, the caller is, of course, absolutely right when she points to the huge amount of financial gifts from these big lobbies, medical lobby and other lobbies, to Obama, and how that is going to be a big obstacle to getting Obama to change policy. Well, it means that when he becomes president, he is going to have to turn from depending on the support of big money, he's going to have to turn from that to the support of the American people. And he's going to have to renounce his allegiance to those that have given him big money. I know that's very that's asking a lot. The Democratic Party is a big money party, just like the Republican Party is a big money party. And, you know, when I read the papers and they say, oh, my God, look at how much money Obama has collected his campaign, and twice as much as McCain, I say, hey, the Democratic Party is supposed to be the party of little people, and here he's accumulating all this money. And these. So, yeah, the caller is right. This is an enormous obstacle, and it just means that the only thing that will counter the influence of these lobbies is the influence of a concerted citizenry which protests and demonstrates and demands and, you know, and says to Obama, you're going to be in trouble from us unless you stop kowtowing to these financial interests, to the health industry and the transport industry and the communications industry. You're going to be in trouble with us. We're going to surround the White House. We're going to picket. We're going to demonstrate. We're going to do all the things that the civil rights movement did in the 1960s. We're going to sit in. We're going to commit civil disobedience. We're going to create turmoil in the country unless you begin listening to us and not to the big money people. That's the only thing that will do it. But this caller is absolutely right. It's a big obstacle to overcome.
I mean, it reminds me of the famous saying of Saul Alinsky that the only way you defeat organized money is with organized people.
Exactly.
And before we go to our next caller, Howard Zinn, I have a question I wanted to ask you. We had another guest on the show who's been on several times, Chalmers Johnson,
yes.
Who I know you're familiar with and who has written a great deal about U.S. foreign policy and U.S. militarism and U.S. empire. Mm. And in our last interview that we had him on the air, he made a sort of chilling point. He was in a fairly pessimistic state about U.S. empire. And with all the bases we have around the world and the amount of economic resources and political influence linked to our military establishment. And he was saying, you know, the United States has to somehow stop being an empire and has to sort of basically disarm itself significantly. And he was what just said is that, you know, looking at history, he doesn't know if there are many instances of empires that have been able to successfully have a soft landing, a peaceful landing, and maintain civilian rule if they try to dismantle an enormous military apparatus. I was wondering what your thoughts are on that sort of, I don't know, 7 days in May or French Fourth Republic scenario that Chalmers Johnson had.
Well, Chalmers Johnson is certainly right about this power, which seems, you know, seems absolutely, you know, unshakable of the American empire. And yes, he has done an enormous amount of good work in you know, doing the research and pointing out we have military bases in over 100 countries, probably a total of like 700 military bases. And it will require a huge dismantling effort, but it can be done. I mean, at one time, remember, they said the sun never sets on the British Empire. British Empire is everywhere. Now the sun sets everywhere on the British Empire. And sure, well, you know, this in a way is parallel to the previous question about the obstacles that lie in the way of change. This is a huge obstacle that lies in the way of change in foreign policy, and that is this enormous dependence on, well, in fact, the economy's dependence on these military bases, except that these military bases are going to drain the American economy. And if we withdrew these military bases, if in short, we became an aggressive military nation, became a peace-loving nation, and committed ourselves to not intervening militarily in other countries in the world. We would save enormous, enormous sums of money, enabling us to join that saving to the saving that I suggested before that comes from taxing the super rich. We would have an enormous sum of money to solve our problems and also to help other people in the world, so that instead of being a military superpower, you know, which gives some Americans pride, well, let's give ourselves pride in a different way. Let's become a humanitarian superpower. Let's use our wealth, let's use our resources to help people in other parts of the world. Instead of, you know, sending planes over to bomb them, send planes with food and medicine and specialists and other kinds of help that they need. Yeah, Chalmers Johnson is perfectly right in pointing to the difficulty of doing that, but there, too, it will take an American public which is sick of war. And maybe it is sick of war. I mean, the fact that we have two-thirds of the American people now sick of this war. And maybe, you know, although the sickness with war, you know, seems to be mitigated after a while, as the sickness that developed after Vietnam seems to be mitigated after a while, as people forget and as the government launches a big propaganda campaign for the next war. And yet, there may be a point reached where the government's efforts to keep war's good name alive, where the government's effort is no longer working. And I'm hopeful that the what we've experienced in this war in Iraq and Afghanistan, that maybe finally we reach a point where the American people are sick, not just of the Iraq war, but of war and of military intervention and of an enormous military budget which drains our wealth, and that therefore that the new citizens movement can demand that the United States change its foreign policy drastically, change its attitude toward the world drastically. That's something we should be working for.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Howard Zinn. You've just been listening to. My name is Bob McChesney. This is WILL AM 580. 1 week from today at this time, we will have our special pre-election show with John Nichols back from last week. But this time, no pledge wrapping, pure politics and media for a full hour. So join us in 1 week. We have a couple of callers waiting patiently. I'm going to get to them right now. But if you do want to join them and have a question or a comment for Howard Zinn, the telephone number here is 333-9455. The toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 4, Farina, you're on the air with Howard Zinn.
Hi, what an amazing honor to be able to call from my little home here in the middle of the Midwest and talk to such world-class scholars. Thank you so much. I've got a radical idea, a couple of them, but how about a constitutional amendment? I want your opinion, Mr. Zinn. A constitutional amendment to have Supreme Court term limits for these right-wing extremist judges and any judge that's giving down, and as they have, bad decisions over the years. Another idea I'd like you to comment on is how about a new Peace Corps that would virtually replace the military, you know, like cut the military by, you know, cut the military radically and put a new revived Peace Corps in these countries around the world to give us back some honor and help for the rest of the world. And thank you once again.
Thank you very much, caller. Howard?
Two very interesting points he makes. And, first, on the constitutional amendment relating to the Supreme Court, I understand the frustration with the Supreme Court. We have these right-wing justices, and they're there for life, and the Republicans took pains to put young people, relatively young people, on the court so they'll last a long time. No, what's the answer to that? I don't think a constitutional amendment, if we could pass a constitutional amendment to do that, it would be fine. But I'm always dubious about thinking that if you put something in the Constitution, you know, it will therefore work. You know, we had too many experiences with constitutional amendments which were just ignored, just as we have experience with laws that are ignored. What brings about change is not a change in law or constitution, but a change in the country and the public opinion, the citizenry. And as far as the Supreme Court goes, we also have to think beyond reliance on the courts, because the federal courts have now been stocked with conservatives for many years now. I mean, Reagan put so many on the court. Bush put so many on the court. Clinton's appointments to the courts were not that great. Somebody did a study showing that Clinton's appointments to the courts were no more left or liberal than Ford's appointments to the court. So the courts are going to be generally against progressive ideas for a long time to come. So what is the answer to that? I think the answer to that is citizens' movements, civil disobedience. Andrew Jackson once said, well, the Supreme Court has made its decision, let it enforce it. Oh, well, let them try to enforce their decisions on a population that won't accept it. After all, when black people sat in the 1960s, they were going against the Supreme Court decisions which had ignored segregation in private places. In other words, the Supreme Court's ruling up to that point was, well, private places can discriminate. Well, black people in the South simply refused to accept that. They used direct action, civil disobedience, to change that situation. And only then did the Supreme Court sort of reluctantly come around. And so I think it will take more than a constitutional amendment, although I wouldn't oppose it, but it would take I wouldn't count on a constitutional amendment, depend on it. I would depend on direct action, citizens' movements on behalf of the things you believe in to weaken the power of conservative judicial decisions. Just as when the court was not in favor of abortion or the right to choose, you know, before Roe v. Wade, I mean, women took things into their own hands. And this is something that historically has been done by the American people when they found the courts unresponsive. Now, on your second point, very, very good point. We have all these young people. We're giving them guns and sending them off to kill and be killed. And no, the Peace Corps could be, you know, when the United States stops being a military power, and then Peace Corps people are not associated with militarism. Oh, yes, the Peace Corps could be a friendly group going in, helping people in other countries. And, you know, we might point to the CCCs, that is the Civil Conservation Corps, which was set up under the New Deal, and where they gave jobs to hundreds of thousands of young people instead of putting them into the military, solving their economic problem that way. They paid young people to do useful things here in this country, to build bridges and highways and playgrounds and clean up rivers and plant trees and did a lot of wonderful things for the environment. So your idea about a true Peace Corps to utilize the human resources that we have and to replace the soldiers overseas with peace people overseas. Excellent idea.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Our guest today on Media Matters again is Howard Zinn. Now let us go to line one. Urbana, thank you for your patience. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
It is an honor to listen to you. I do not have a question for you, but I have a comment from one of your callers that called and talking about Obama was taking money from lobbyists and things. He's not taking money from lobbyists and things. He got money from Fannie Mae, just like McCain got money from Fannie Mae. McCain's campaign manager, Rick Davis, was taking money from people and things up until a month ago. I am 72 years old, and I have never given to a presidential campaign before in my life. First time I gave $100, the second time I gave $50, the third time $50, the fourth time $50, the fifth time $50, and the sixth time $50. And I don't have no lot of money, you know. I'm on Social Security, I'm barely making it, you know. But I sacrificed that because I think that Obama would make a wonderful president. I voted for Hillary in the primaries. And then as time went by and things, I, you know, kind of switched over because she was kind of getting on my nerves. I loved Clinton, and some of the things that she was saying kind of got to me, you know. But I hate it when people get on the phone and lie like they do. You have people like me. I'm in a $60,000 home on Social Security, and millions of us all over the United States that's given to this young man. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Howard, do you have any comments?
Well, you know, this caller has, I think, made a strong point that, sure, Obama is getting money from big lobbyists. He's also been getting a lot of money from people like her. He's been getting a lot of money from people who don't have a lot of money, people who've never given in campaigns before. And our hope is that these are the people he will listen to when he becomes president, that he will recognize that his true constituency is not the rich lobbyists, even though they may have donated money to him, but his true constituency is people like this woman on Social Security who took hard-earned money and gave it his campaign. And there are many, many, many such people. So, you know, there's some hope in that.
Let's go now to our phone lines again. We are going to line 2, Wasika. You're on the air with Howard Zinn.
Mr. Zinn, I like what you're saying.
Thank you.
I do have a way of eliminating some of the lobby money. I think if we have, you were talking about single-payer insurance.
Yeah.
That was a hard sell, and it's still going to be a hard sell. Right now, an easier sell might be single-payer mortgage. And I've talked to a couple of bank people who like the idea.
Single-payer mortgage?
Yes.
Now, by that, are you talking about the government handling the mortgages instead of private banks?
No, the banks would still handle the mortgage. You see, the bank would have the single-payer paperwork, and they would have to follow all of the rules that were on the paperwork, just like in Social Security, A, B, C, and D, and everything. But they would have the option of being nearby. You like the banker. They could offer. The details have to be worked out. But it is an intriguing idea. I tried to start a movement, and I fizzled.
Well,
someone like yourself might. If we could just get a popular movement going to get single-payer mortgage accomplished, then single-payer insurance might follow, and that would be less lobbyists again. Anyway, I'll let you go.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Howard, any comments?
Well,
maybe extending that to...
Well, certainly, this mortgage crisis
came
about because of the greed of banks and lending institutions and intermediaries, and it is extremely important that the government step into this situation and make sure that people do not pay excessive mortgage rates, interest rates, and where people have trouble paying their mortgages, the government should be stepping in and helping them. Not one foreclosure should take place. Nobody should lose their home because they can't afford to pay the mortgage. Where they are in trouble like that, the government should be their savior. So in that sense, although I don't know the details of this single-payer mortgage plan, I like the sentiment behind it, and that is we ought to get away from the present sort of greed-driven mortgage system and have the government step in to make sure that people can keep their homes.
Now let's go back to the phone lines to line three. Urbana, you're on the air with Howard Zinn.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi. Having a nice show today, and it is true that WILL attracts some awfully nice people to, as guests on their shows. Just a quick comment. You were talking a little while ago about what we would need to do in order to keep the next president in line, if you will, with the ideas and the ideologies of the people. And I think you left out a real big piece there, and it's kind of ironic because you did it. So on this show, there's a lot. There has been a great deal of public discontent over the war in Iraq, and things like the protests at the Republican convention. But if the media doesn't cover it, it doesn't go anywhere because people don't know that they've got brothers and sisters around the country that are doing the same thing. So I think that we have a major problem with the media shutting out the protests. And if the media doesn't come around, then how would that change with the next presidency? I'll hang up. Thanks.
Howard?
Oh. No, that's a very important point, and that is that it's true. There's a lot of protest in this country that goes on. Nobody knows about it. It's a big country. And it's interesting that in the Federalist Papers way back, James Madison sort of saw safety for the new government in the fact that it was a big, big country and that protest would be dispersed across the country, so couldn't concentrate and threaten the government. And we have this situation with the media, you know, that it's a big country. People in Cincinnati don't know what people in San Francisco are doing. There are anti-war vigils and anti-war protests taking place all over the country that nobody knows about because the media won't report them. Now, this caller says, well, how can we get the media to report them? Well, of course, one way is to protest directly to the media, to bombard the media with your local newspaper with letters saying, why didn't you cover this? Why did you omit this? Why did you give so much space to this and not so much space to that? I mean, that's one thing to do, not let the media go their own way unperturbed. And the other way is to support the alternative media. We do have alternative media. Well, look at this radio program. Look at there are community radio stations around the country. There is Pacifica. There is Democracy Now. There are all these radio stations around the country, which don't have the power of NBC, ABC, but they have the power to reach several million people in this country. Let's support them, utilize them. Let's utilize the internet. I mean, the internet has become a very powerful democratic tool for countering the monopoly control of the media. I mean, Bogdan Chesney has done a great job in exposing the monopoly control of the media and pointing to this as a very critical problem for American democracy. So, you know, you the caller, are absolutely right in pointing to the fact that the media are an obstacle to creating a movement. So we have to do as movements have always done in history, build our own media.
Now let's go to one more caller, this time line four on a cell phone somewhere in this great country. You're on the air with Howard Zinn.
Yes, thank you very much. With all due respect, sir, going back to your idea of downsizing or getting rid of our military, I mean, that'd be the most dangerous move our country could ever make. There's terrorists around the world who hate us, and all they want is the demise of the U.S., the United States of America. They'd be jumping for joy. I mean, it's a sad fact, but they hate us, and nothing we can do is going to change that. Anyway, I'll hang up and let you comment, sir.
Thank you very much, caller. Well, Howard Zinn?
That's an important comment because I'm sure a lot of people think that way, but I'd like to point this out to the caller. And that is all the military bases that we had at the time of 9/11. Remember? Time of 9/11, we had all those military bases we have now. And time of 11, we had a huge military budget. Time of 9/11, we had 10,000 nuclear weapons. What did that do about terrorism? Did that stop 9/11? No. Terrorism isn't stymied, isn't prevented by having a huge military. In fact, I might point out the opposite. and that is that the more military bases you have in other countries, the more you trouble people in other countries. They don't want our military bases. Oh, the governments want them because the governments are usually not very democratic governments. The people don't want them. The people in Japan do not want our military bases on Okinawa. People in South Korea do not want their military bases in South Korea. The people of the Philippines have protested the military bases in the Philippines. And these military bases just arouse people to opposition to the United States. If you want to do something about terrorism, you can't do it with military bases. You can't do it with war. You can't do it with bombing. What you do when you bomb people, you create more terrorists. You create more anger. I mean, where does terrorism come from? Where does terrorism originate? Terrorism comes from anger against American intervention in other countries, American occupations of other countries. So if you want to do something about terrorism, military bases, bombs, nuclear weapons, that's not going to help. What you have to do is change your foreign policy and become a peace-loving nation. Now, you don't see Sweden and Norway and New Zealand and Holland, and you don't see them worrying about terrorism. Now, why is that? They don't bother other people in the world. They don't send their planes and ships all over the world. So a lot of people in the United States have the mistaken idea that the military bases protect us. They don't protect us. They're dangerous to us. And so the best thing we can do if we want to do something about terrorism is become a peace-loving nation.
We have time for one very short caller. I want to get to line one, Champaign County. If we can get an abridged call, that'd be great.
Okay. I'm glad the graphic novel version of People's History is coming out. I'm still waiting for the video version that was ill-fated some years ago. But I wanted to mention that Alexander Coburn is apparently on Biden watch, and this remark he made about the test of Obama has some really disturbing content in it, where he's actually appealing for support for an apparently wrong policy that he expects to have to sell to the U.S. And I don't actually know if he's talking about attacking Iran in some way or adding to the covert attack that's ongoing already, but I'd like some comments on that, and I wanted to just raise that issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much, caller.
So, well, I don't know the specific issue that Alex Coburn is pointing to, but certainly Biden, as a vice presidential candidate, does not give us much hope because Biden has been rather militaristic. He voted for the war and voted for, huge military budgets. But certainly Obama has to be criticized and called to account for calling for sending troops to Afghanistan. We ought to tell Obama that what we want, and I think most of the American people want this, so Obama's misreading the American people when he doesn't do this. What the American people want is for us to get out of Iraq. And Obama should be saying we should get out of Iraq, not in 16 months, not in 2 years, not partially, but totally, because we have just ruined that country and ruined our own country in the process.
Howard Zinn, on that note, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they want to kick me out of the studio. I want to thank you so much for taking an hour of your time to join us. It's been a real pleasure and an honor to have you on the air with us for the last hour.
It's good of you to invite me, Bob. You're doing good work.
I appreciate that very much. I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer. I want to thank Paul Diefenbaugh for working the board for us today. I'll be back in 167 hours. And have a great week, everyone.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, partly sunny skies this afternoon and there's a chance of showers, the high around 90 degrees. Tonight, mostly cloudy skies with a low of 72. Partly sunny on Monday with a high of 88. Monday night, partly cloudy with a low of 73. And Tuesday, partly sunny with a high around 90. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana.